Hello, everybody. Charisse here with a very special announcement. I am thrilled to share that RCAT is now an official AIA continuing education provider. With this remarkable distinction, RCAT has launched RCATemy, a continuing education platform for the busy AEC professional. And here's the really exciting part. You can now earn continuing education credits by doing exactly what you are doing right now. That's right, you can now earn AIA credits by listening to select episodes of Detail. Whether you're working around the house, on your commute, or stuck in a waiting room, just listen, take a brief quiz, and your credit will automatically be recorded with AIA. It's really that simple. Plus, bonus points that much of our content qualifies for that elusive HSW credit. And we all know how valuable those are. What more could you ask for? We aim to please. Find out more at rcat.com/continuing-education or follow the link in our show notes. And thank you for tuning in to the RCAT Detailed podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com. Hi, Charisse here, host of the RCAT Detailed podcast. I recently had the opportunity to join the RCAT team at the AIA Conference on Architecture and Design in Boston. Every year, the AIA and AEC community convenes to network, share knowledge, and discuss today's most pressing issues. On the expo floor, AIA 25 fosters cross-industry collaborations and solutions across the entire spectrum of the AEC industry. I joined RCAT under the Big Red A to speak with several interesting people and companies who are delivering solutions to design a better world. We are bringing those conversations to you here as bonus content. Enjoy. My guest today is Chuck Haba, president of Telling Industries. Chuck joined Telling in 2017 with a background in operations, engineering, and research and development. Chuck has 26 issued patents over his career. Wow, that's impressive. And utilized his background to help Telling launch multiple new products for commercial construction infrastructure. With his vast industry knowledge and creativity, Chuck has helped bring innovation to the framing industry. Chuck, welcome to Detailed. How are you doing?
Good. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us on this first morning of the AIA. How's it going so far?
So far, so good. It's good weather, and I'm hoping we'll have a good turnout with a lot of participants in this show.
So you call that humid heat box outside the
yes.
weather.
The sun's out. Okay, no rain.
My hair is not happy about that good weather. So let's start by first learning a little bit about you before we start getting into our questions. Give me a 5-minute, just brief introduction of your company and your products.
Certainly. So Telling Industries, we make metal framing and accessories for commercial construction. The simplest way to think of it is a metal 2x4. Unlike a wood 2x4, our products are mostly C-shaped, so they're hollow, and you can nest two of them together, which takes up half the space of a corresponding wood stud. The other advantage is they're a lot lighter, so they lend themselves to being lifted up to 30 stories tall to do very tall buildings. Another advantage of the metal framing is it doesn't burn like wood does. So if you're concerned about being in a top of a 10-story hotel, as we are here in Boston, and there was a fire on the first floor, with metal framing, it's not as much of a concern with a flammability risk. We've got 4 plants throughout the country. One is in Florida, Connecticut, Ohio, and Arkansas.
So I'm sitting here thinking, being a West Coaster, when am I getting one on the West Coast?
We have no interest in moving to the West Coast at this moment. We've tried that in our past. We had a plant in Arizona. One of the problems is we don't have a lot of synergies with our core existing 4 plants. How do we get steel out to the West Coast? Who do we buy from? So in my mind, to go out west, it's go big or go home. So I don't think we could do one plant out west. We'd have to do three or four. And at this moment, we just recently expanded into Florida in 2024. So we're going to get that right before we look at the West Coast. And there's plenty of other viable metal framing suppliers on the West Coast that we have some partnerships with.
I can appreciate that. I'm also a big fan of go big or go home. So just let me know when you're moving our direction. So your products and materials, pretty much any construction type, or do you have a specific place that your framing is best used for?
I think all metal framers would love to sell more into residential. Unfortunately, the residential market tends to not use as much metal framing. It tends to be more wood. That's more related to the installation base. Studies show that if you look at the installers and contractors who put up residential, they change. They don't move with the job. So if you were to do a job 100 miles away from your current one, it's an all-new labor force 100 miles away. You could find carpenters who can work with wood 100 miles away. Where for metal framing, the contract installation base move with the job. They would actually relocate, move 100 miles away, and install that. So metal framing can take you a day or two to learn how to work with it. It's not hard. It's just different. It's different drill speeds. It's different saws that you cut it with. So it's more different than hard. But once you go through that training, if your labor force moves with the job, then it's more advantageous to use metal.
So I'm going down my first rabbit hole already and haven't even got to my real questions. Just did an episode about wildfire construction and wildfire resistant construction. And one of the things they're talking about for residential, I mean, obviously we've had some major damage in numerous places in the last couple of years from wildfires in urban areas. One of the things they're really talking about is using more metal framing in residential construction. Are you seeing any of that yet?
We are starting to, predominantly in the markets that we don't serve on the West Coast, where wildfires have certainly been a tragedy. But we do service Texas and a little bit of New Mexico, and we're starting to see a little bit more metal framing in residential there. In the markets that we serve, not for wildfires, but more due to the fact that heat and humidity do horrible things to wood, warp it, curve it, you name it. Our Florida market tends to use a lot of masonry block for the exterior walls and then metal framing for the interior. So we're starting to see that proliferation into residential as well.
Interesting. So as you know, we were chatting a little bit before this interview. As I told you, my day job is as a spec writer for a large building enclosure company. And I've worked in architecture, I've worked in construction, I've worked in MEP engineering. One of the things that's really difficult for us spec writers is we write a spec and that project goes out and we never hear back on how things went from the spec we wrote or if there were any problems in our spec so that we can get better as spec writers or we misunderstood something in a manufacturer's information. With your type of products, what are the most, I want you to teach me something today so I'm a better spec writer when I get back to my desk on Monday. What are some of the issues that you see happening on a project strictly due to something somebody like me didn't understand or didn't know with your type of product? And so we specified it incorrectly. And go ahead and be brutally honest. I can take it.
Well, I'm not sure if this directly relates to spec writing, but the number one issue with our metal framing and the installation base is the MEP pass-throughs tend to chop holes in our framing, which of course lessens the structural strength of it. And then we are constantly having metal framing that isn't passing inspection. It's got to be torn out. It's got to be replaced because someone couldn't fit through that HVAC pass-through or that electrical line or that plumbing line. So they've just decided to cut holes in it to pass that through. So if there was something in spec writing, I would say when it comes to framing, leave room and plan for all of the MEP and utility pass-throughs. That's been one of the largest things that we've seen. Some of the others that we've seen more frequently have been really just overspecified. The gamut of metal framing ranges from 10 gauge to 28 gauge and everything in between. And I think there's a tendency in a lot of spec writing to overspecify. And then when you get to the installation base and the contractor base, you start to get to where you're really adding a lot more cost to the project than you'd need to. And often it is a challenging debate to say, let's change that spec to something that can handle this load and work in this application that maybe could save 10, 15% on the cost.
I cannot tell you how much I love that you just said that.
because I not only write specs, I also teach a lot. And one of the issues we have in the industry right now, just for you, to help you in dealing with people like me, is a lot of the spec writers became spec writers later in their career, and they're boomers and they're leaving. But they didn't do a very good job of mentoring new spec writers behind them. And there is no program you can go take to learn to be a spec writer. And so what is a habit in a lot of firms right now is architects are going and just cutting and pasting your spec into their spec. And they're like, I'm safest if I just leave it all in there and don't modify very much and end up in exactly the situation you're talking about. But you knowing that may help you look at maybe different ways to approach how you're giving your spec to me. Now, I'm not going to do that because I am a trained spec writer, but probably 95% of the people writing specs with your guide specs, which I haven't seen, so I can't judge you, are not. And so they don't know what you can and can't do in a spec. So that's really interesting because I think it gave us both an opportunity to make our listeners think about something.
It is. The other issue that will come up from the outside looking in, sometimes it feels as if a lot of the specs that we see are cut and pasted from years prior. And indeed, some of the manufacturers on them have been out of business for a decade. So we will get specs, and just here's an example. We've got a competitor that merged two companies together in 2012, but we still see specs that list them separately, and that doesn't exist. There was a company called Unimast that hasn't been in business since, I don't know, 2005, yet we see that company on specs as well. So that's some of the challenges that we see on specs, is really that over-specification at times, and then listing manufacturers that haven't been in business for a decade or more.
Well, and that is one of my pet peeves as well. One of the things I teach about, do not copy an old project specs, because you did the work on that one. You think you're saving yourself time and money, because you're not, because things are changing daily.
You're probably costing yourself a lot of money. And case in point, when I spoke about the different gauges that are available in metal framing and the different solutions that are out there, a decade ago or two decades ago, there was half of that. So the industry has progressed by adding new technology, adding more solutions to dial it in for what that building needs. And if you were copying a spec from a decade ago, there weren't as many solutions there. And now you could dial it in more and get just the right gauge, just the right product, just the right flange that you need to solve for that application, instead of overspecifying by spending more because that technology and those products didn't exist a decade ago.
Well, and you might save a couple hours during your design by copying this old project. You will spend 10 times or more that during CA dealing with the problems you created because you didn't do your homework. Specs deserve attention for that project on every project. There is no such thing as a cookie cutter spec that works on every project. So I love that you shared that. So anything else you want to tell me that I do wrong? And I know we're not talking about me, my spec writer community, before we talk about construction.
Well, just to put some perspective to what we were talking about with the specs and carrying over an old one. If you think about it, what is an extra hour of the spec writer's time to research it? A typical quote for us is $1 million worth of metal on a project. And when I say it's overspecified and that's 10% more, that's $100,000 more. And I would challenge whether or not a spec writer an extra hour of their time is worth $100,000. So just to put some color to it, I think there's some real savings to do a little bit more homework on writing the specs up front. Now, that's not to say there's not some spec writing firms and some people that have been trained professionally that do an absolutely wonderful job of writing specs. And we're always happy to see those as well.
Can I use that in my... What is an hour of a spec writer's time? At least $100,000. But sometimes it's much more. Sometimes it's litigation. Sometimes it's, you know, having to go into advanced dispute resolution processes. That time was nothing. But people who aren't trained, and I'm not faulting the architecture community, but we are here at AIA. They're not being taught about contract documents and what will get you in trouble. They're being taught on the job. But if the people on the job didn't learn properly, then what I call it, the cycle of abuse. So they just pass it down to the next guy.
They do.
So hopefully we help change a little bit of that. So outside of my day job, I do a lot of podcast interviews with architects about their projects. And one of my favorite questions, which applies to manufacturers as well, is, so tell me about construction. That's where the rubber meets hits the road. If you did a good job on your documents, construction always has challenges, but it's going to go pretty well. If you didn't, you're going to have a hot mess during construction. Or sometimes you have contractors that cut corners, and that results in issues. Or they don't understand the contract documents, and they can't just use something else. They're not allowed to do that. So tell me what kinds of things directly related to your product you see happen during construction that you can educate, whether it's contractors or design professionals. Tell me what you see go wrong, that something you tell me today will make me do better or make them do better.
Certainly. First, I would say that for most of the reputable contractors that we do business with, I have to admit that they don't cut corners. You know, your nationwide contractors have a system, a QC program, and I haven't seen them cut corners to the extent that a more localized contractor might. So I think there's a lot of policing and a lot of checking that to ensure that corners aren't cut. However, what we do see with a lot of the nationwide contractors, there can be a lot of changeovers on a project. And again, those changeovers, we have heard some nationwide contractors say that they'll take a job at slim profits and they'll make it up in the changeovers later because they're counting on those specifications to not follow through and dot every I and cross every T, which leaves it wide open for changeovers as you go throughout the project. So we've seen more of the change order side to get it right. I feel very safe walking into buildings such as the one we're in today, because to be honest, I haven't seen a lot of the cutting corners. It's more of the changeovers and then the tendency to overspecify and overspend.
That's great advice. And it's funny that you say that, especially on public work. Some contractors will comb through those documents for every possible change order they can get later so they can get that lowest price, because that's the only way you get the job, is to be the low bidder and then make it up in change orders later. But there's an actual book out there. The guy that wrote this book should be paying me royalties as much as I recommend this book, because it's terrifying. And it's called The Contractor's Guide to Change Orders. And it's about a 300-page detailed description of how to find the mistakes in the design documents to get more money out of the contract. And I throw it at design professionals all the time. You look at this, then you come back and tell me I'm wrong. But that's great advice. And again, getting it right the first time, doing that up front saves you so much in the long run that I'll just deal with it during construction is about the worst words that can come out of anybody's mouth, because that's the most expensive time and usually the most damaging.
It is. And to segue into something that we do for manufacturing, that's very true in manufacturing as well. Getting it right off of our roll formers is far more cost effective than trying to QC that through our packaging or shipping or handling when it gets to the job site, so on and so forth. So I would agree with that. Getting it right at the start, I think, is proven in a multitude of industries to save you more money in the long run.
So finally, and this is your chance to say whatever you like, tell me what's new or amazing or exciting at Telling Industries that you want me to know about.
Well, we pride ourselves in trying to come up with innovative solutions for contractor needs and for building needs. One of the ones that we came up with was a product called VersaDry, and it is a track that goes on the floor and stands the gypsum 2 inches up off the ground. That helps with water mitigation, flooding. It also just so happens that it passes a 1 and 2 hour fire rating without the need for fire caulk. So that's one of the new products that we thought would help solve a problem for water damage and water mitigation when the gypsum is at the ground level, and then it will soak it up into the drywall or gypsum. We thought we would come up with a solution for that. Some of our other items that we're working on, it amazed me when we came up with it a couple years ago. There's no one who has embossed a ruler onto a stud. So we came out and we actually put tick marks onto a stud that mark it off in a quarter inch increments, you know, up to 12 inches to try to put a ruler on a stud, just to make it a little bit easier for people in the field to tell if they needed to cut it back a little bit, to tell where to cut. So we pride ourselves on trying to come up with a couple of things that would help installation labor. And our mindset, we think that is going to be, it is today and it's only going to get worse, with a labor problem for contractors in our industry.
It's definitely getting worse. And that is genius. Like, I just listened to you talk about putting those ruler marks on the stud, and I'm like, how is it we didn't do that from the very beginning of time?
Yeah, I don't know. It's on gypsum, but it was never on metal framing. So.
Do you think contractors maybe don't trust it?
That I don't know. We patent it, so we're the only ones who do it today, so that's why it hasn't spread more. But the contractors who've used our studs with those tick marks on it, we've got nothing but favorable feedback, and they like it a lot.
Very nice. Chuck, thank you for joining me today. This has been an absolute delight. I look forward to going to check out your products more on your website. You better have a good guide spec because I'm going to look now. Fair warning.
Our pleasure. I should put in a call out for ARCAD in that one of the best ways to see the most recent manufacturers and specs are to find it in places and repositories such as ARCAD, which we're listed in. And if you needed to download our specs, that would be the best place to look at this moment.
Well, that's great advice. As a spec writer, I use a lot of resources to research products, but honestly, and this, I'm not saying this because I host ARCAD's podcast. I am not paid to promote them, but I also don't say I believe in something I don't believe in. And I use their website a lot when I need to do product research and I need to get documents quickly and easily, or run through their spec wizard to put together something quickly that I don't have in my spec software. So for those of you out there, there's some great stuff. So check that out. And Chuck, thank you again for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit arcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around arcat.com. For over 30 years, ARCAD has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try ARCAD and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit ARCAD.com. That's ARCAD.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.